The River by Rumour Godden. A porpoise came down, turning slowly over and over in midstream, with a beautiful, easy armchair rhythmical motion that lulled Harriet. She rubbed her back against a post and picked at her finger lump with her hand. Oh well, thought Harriet comfortably. I shall meet heaps of people when I'm older, when I'm famous. Heaps of things are going to happen to me. A weir and a splash made her jump so that she almost fell off the jetty. A kingfisher had struck from a branch above her. Now it sat on a post with a fish still bending and jerking in its beak. The poor fish had been placidly, happily swimming and feeling somewhere under the jetty, and then, out of its element, from another, it had been seized and carried off. And swallowed, thought Harriet regretfully, watching it disappear. I wonder what the other fishes think, thought Harriet. But then, that was the same with any dying. One person was seized and taken away. What does it feel like if that comes right plumb in the middle of your family? She could not think of it. It seemed impossible, and yet she had just seen it happen. Things do happen, she told herself. But she was lulled again with the sound of a river running in her ears. Those are fishes, Harriet told herself comfortably. Only fishes. There was no sign of a splash. The river ran steadily where it had been. There you see. Anything can happen. Anything. And whatever happens, the other fishes just go on wriggling and swimming and feeding because we have to, said Harriet. The river had to go on. Whatever happened, a fish death, a wreck, storm, sun, the river assimilated it all. The far bank showed as a line across the river, a line of fields, a clump of trees by the temple, and, further away, the walls and roofs and chimney and jetty of Valerie Faber's works. I wonder what he thinks about dying. Captain John, not Valerie's father, thought Harriet idly. I wonder if he thinks the same as he thinks about being born. If he really thinks you could die over and over again. Goodness, thought Harriet. I nearly died just now when I nearly fell off a jetty. I would die if I saw that cobra. The Last Days of Terra Nova by Manuel Rivas, translated by Jacob Rogers. Galicia, Fall 2014. There they are, the two of them, on the rocks beneath the lighthouse, a man and a woman. Clandestine. I'm facing the sea and I'm afraid that if I turn around, it will all disappear forever, them included. That if I look back, all I'll find is an immense nothingness traversed by the horizon line. A fossil with memories traveling along it the way Garua is doing now, as she rides her bike with a packet of books in the saddlebag. But the lighthouse will suddenly flash on in the middle of the day, and a fuming ray of black light will cross the city and shine its accusatory spotlight onto Terra Nova. Onto the sign in the window where I wrote, total liquidation of all inventory due to imminent closure. I shouldn't have written that message. I can picture the eyes poring over the last of the books, weighing their value, their health, color, musculature, and the state of their spines. Meanwhile, the books are in a state of shock as they feel the ground vanish out from under them. I have to go back and take it down, the sign. I have to take it down. I should lie and write liquidation due to death of owner. I should be out there instead, on the front lines. What are you doing here, Mr. Fontana? Waiting for death, like everyone else. That might earn me a round of applause, no more than that, an ovation. It would ignite a glimmer of hope. I lived that prophecy. I wore it as a badge after I gave up my role as a White Duke. no future. It horrifies me to think we were right. Right. It was the last thing we wanted to be, like discovering only now that our deliberate grotesquerie was a form of beauty. That the layer of grime was a form of protection. Very poor indeed art thou, yet thy home is heaven, I trow. That prayer always brings me peace. Jacopone da Todi, my poet, a gift from Uncle Elisio when I was in the iron lung. Bread and water, nothing more, but some herbs, unless indeed these a little salt shall need. I shall go back and take down that sign, but I'm afraid to leave. Tropism by Natalie Sarote, translated by Maria Jolas. They had come to live in the quiet little streets behind the Pantheon, near the Rue Gay-Lussac or the Rue Saint-Jacques, in apartments given onto dark courtyards, perfectly decent, however, and comfortably equipped. This was what was offered them here, this, and freedom to do what they wanted, to walk about as they wanted, in any sort of get-up with any sort of face, on the homely little streets. Here no formal behavior was required of them, no activities in common with others, no sentiments, no memories. They were offered an existence that was at once despoiled and protected, an existence like a waiting room in a deserted suburban railway station. A bare, gray, lukewarm room with a black stove in the middle and wooden benches along the walls. And they were contented. They liked it here. They felt almost at home. They were on good terms with Madame la Concierge, with a grocery woman. They took their clothes to the most conscientious and least expensive cleaner in the neighborhood. They never tried to recall the place in the country where once they had played. They never tried to recapture the color and the smell of a little town they had grown up in. They never saw suddenly appear before their mind's eye, when walking along the streets in their neighborhood, when looking in the shop windows, when they went past the concierge door and greeted her very politely. They never saw rise up in their recollections a bit of wall inundated with life, or the paving stones of a courtyard, vivid and caressing, or the gentle steps of a front stoop on which they had sat in their childhood. On the stairway in their house, they occasionally met the tenant downstairs, a teacher who came home from school with his two kids at 4 o'clock. All three had pale eyes set in long heads as shiny and smooth as large ivory eggs. The door of their apartment opened narrowly for a second to allow them to pass. They were seen to put their feet on little felt squares laid out on the interest floor, and move silently away, gliding towards the dark end of a corridor.
Annie Ernaux, Simple Passion. I was unaffected by the inconveniences of daily life. I didn't worry about a 2-month postal strike, since A never wrote to me, no doubt the cautious attitude of a married man. I would sit calmly through traffic jams and queue patiently at the bank, and was not annoyed by the surly attitude of the clerk. Nothing could make me lose my temper. I felt pain, sympathy, and compassion for other people. I understood the outcasts lying on benches, the clients of prostitutes, or a passenger engrossed in her Mills and Boone romance, although I was incapable of saying why I resembled them. One day, as I was going naked to the fridge to get some beer, I remembered the women, single or married, mothers with children, living in my old neighbourhood who secretly received a man in the afternoon. Rumour was rife. It was impossible to say whether people reproached them for their improper conduct or for the fact that they devoted the daylight hours to lovemaking instead of cleaning the windows. I thought of these women with acute satisfaction. During all this time, I felt I was living out my passion in the manner of a novel. But now I am not sure in which style I am writing about it, whether in the style of a testimony or possibly even the sort of confidence that can be found in women's magazines, maybe a manifesto or a statement, or perhaps a critical commentary. I am not giving the account of a liaison. I am not telling a story, half of which escapes me, based on a precise "he came on the 11th of November," or an approximate chronology, weeks went by. As far as I was concerned, that notion did not enter the relationship. I could experience only absence or presence. I am merely listing the signs of a passion, wavering between one day and every day, as if this inventory could allow me to grasp the reality of my passion. Naturally, in the listing and description of these facts, there is no irony or derision, which are ways of telling things to people or to oneself after the event, and not experiencing them at the time. As for the origins of my passion, I have no intention of searching for them in my early history, which can be reconstituted with the help of a psychoanalyst, or in my recent history, or for that matter in the cultural standards governing emotion, which have influenced me since childhood. Gone with the Wind, Phèdre, or the songs of Edith Piaf are just as decisive as the Oedipus complex. I do not wish to explain my passion. That would imply that it was a mistake or some disorder I needed to justify, but simply to describe it. The only criteria to be taken into account, perhaps, should be a material order, the time and freedom at my disposal throughout the affair. Tony Jutt, The Memory Chalet. And yet, New York remains a world city. It is not the great American city, that will always be Chicago. New York sits at the edge, like Istanbul or Mumbai. Its distinctive appeal lies precisely in its cantankerous relationship to the metropolitan territory beyond. It looks outward, and is thus attractive to people who would not feel comfortable further inland. It has never been American in the way that Paris is French. New York has always been about something else as well. Shortly after arriving here, I wandered into a local tailor's shop to get something altered. After measuring me, the elderly owner glanced up. "Where you take your laundry?" "Well," I responded, "to the Chinese laundry at the corner." He rose and gave me a long, hard look, peeling away layers of Paris, Cambridge, South London, Antwerp, and points east. "Why are you taking the laundry to the Chinaman?" Today I dropped my cleaning off with Joseph the tailor, and we exchanged Yiddishisms and reminiscences, his of Jewish Russia. Two blocks south, I lunch at Bar Pitti, whose Florentine owner disdains credit cards and prepares the best Tuscan food in New York. In a hurry, I can opt instead for a falafel from the Israelis on the next block. I might do even better with the sizzling lamb from the Arab at the corner. 50 meters away are my barbers, Giuseppe, Franco and Salvatore, all from Sicily, their English echoing Chico Marx. They have been in Greenwich Village forever, but never really settled. How should they? They shout at one another all day in Sicilian dialect, drowning out their main source of entertainment and information, a 24-hour Italian language radio station. On my way home, I enjoy a millefeuille from Claude, a surly Breton pâtissier who has put his daughter through the London School of Economics, one exquisite éclair at a time. All this within two blocks of my apartment, and I am neglecting the Sikh newsstand. The Hungarian bakery and the Greek diner, well, actually Albanian, but we pretend otherwise. three streets east, and I have Little Habsburgia, Ukrainian restaurant, Uni 8 Church, Polish grocery, and, of course, the long-established Jewish deli, serving East European staples under kosher labels. All that is missing is a Viennese cafe. For this, symptomatically, you must go uptown to the wealthy quarters of the city. Such variety is doubtless available in London, but the cultures of contemporary London are balkanised by district and income. Canary Wharf, the financial hub, keeps its distance from the ethnic enclaves at the centre. Contrast Wall Street with an easy walking distance of my neighbourhood. As for Paris, it has its sequestered quarters where the grandchildren of Algerian guest workers rub shoulders with Senegalese street vendors. Amsterdam, its Surinamese and Indonesian districts. But these are the backwash of empire, what Europeans now refer to as the immigrant question. One must not romanticise. I am sure most of my neighbourhood traders and artisans have never met and would have little to say to one another. At night, they return home to Queens or New Jersey. If I told Joseph or Sal they had the good fortune to live in a world city, they would probably snort. But they do, just as the Barrow Boys of early 20th century Hoxton were citizens of the same cosmopolitan London that Keynes memorialised in The Economic Consequences of the Peace, even though they would have had no idea what he was talking about. Ian Sinclair, Lights Out for the Territory. Abney Park was still waiting. I held back from the book barrow and dutifully copied the Berlin Road graffiti into my Europa notepad. Then we legged it. Stoke Newington Road stretches onwards like the rubber neck of a chicken. We drift past exotic minimarts, deleted cinemas, tributary nameplates with literary associations. The Hasidic foothills have always been disputed land. Jews escaping from Whitechapel sweatshops, early West Indian immigrants, as depicted in Alexander Baron's novel, The Lowlife. Baron, troubled after the war, wandered the borough like a fetch, watching, listening, hungry for clues that would allow him to reorientate himself. He returned to his mother's house in Hackney, needing a safe place in which to heal the trauma of combat, familiar territory he no longer recognised. Like the neo-romantic account of Mare Street, produced by John Minton for the dust wrapper of Roland Camberton's Rain on the Pavement. Baron found himself crisscrossing the East End in a series of mazy traverses, eavesdropping on conversations in cafes, reading the reflections in the windows of tailor shops, a landscape that had not yet been optioned. Bomb-damaged terraces, wilderness gardens, green shoots amongst the rubble. From the City from the Plough, Baron's first novel, was published by Jonathan Cape in 1948. It was a success of a kind that is no longer imaginable, numerous impressions in hardback and paperback. Baron, a modest man, was inveigled into attending a celebratory party in Bedford Square. He took the bus from Dalston Junction, had a few solitary whiskies in an anonymous pub to steady his nerves, looked up at the lighted room, the buzz, turned on his heel, went home. The Lowlife came at the other end of Baron's career in 1963, a few years before he slipped gracefully out of print with Franco's Dying, to become one of the re-forgotten. The Lowlife featured Harry Boy Boas, a Hoffman presser who works only as much as he has to, a gambler with an even more destructive addiction, the love of literature. Harry Boy, true to genre, true to Night in the City, The Small World of Sammy Lee, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, keeps on the move, cheating fate, ducking and diving, a post-existential loser. He's pursued by a diminutive strong-arm man in a cylindrical coat, a literal torpedo. Flush, he makes expeditions to Soho for fat Italian meals, cigars, women, and second-hand bookshops. Then he hides out, stays in bed, working his way through yards of Zola. I knew what my programme was going to be for the next few weeks. I can go off on a jag with books like some people do with liquor, weeks at a time. Stoke Newington is the perfect location in which to stay lost. Limboland, London's interzone. Large, shabby properties that ask no questions. Internal exile with a phony rent book. Stoke Newington is the place where terrorists behave like unpublished poets, and poets cultivate a justified paranoia.
Mazen mon amour, Katia Oskamp. Herr Hübner, most of my clients are regulars and pay me a visit every 4 to 7 weeks. Over time, I've got to know these clients, their foibles and their quirks, their life stories, their fates. I'm fond of them, I know what they like, and I'm always pleased to see them again, safe and well, after a few weeks. With their frequent care, my regulars' feet are in good condition. Every now and then, so-called walk-in customers show up, even though they can't walk very well. Painful corns, ingrown toenails, and the acute consequences of a bloody self-experiment in the privacy of their own bathroom drive them to our salon. These walk-in customers also include out-of-towners, people with vouchers, people who only attach temporary importance to how their feet look, a spa break, a stay in hospital, or a new girlfriend. Sometimes I manage to convert a walk-in customer to a regular if the first appointment goes well. Tiffy calls people who come to the salon on the first time newbies. When a newbie arrives at our salon, I place bets with myself. Follow-up appointment? Tip? Apology? I always bet on the apology and I always win. It doesn't matter whether it's a construction site foreman or someone who fancies himself tattooed from head to foot, whether it's a pregnant woman or an old one, whether they're academics or without two brain cells to rub together. In actual fact, everyone who takes their shoes off in the chiropody room for the first time apologizes for their feet. It makes no difference what condition they're in. It's all new and unfamiliar. The contact is a little too intimate. It's embarrassing. All of this is reflected in the apology. One Wednesday morning, I read the name Herr Hübner in the diary. Do you know him? I asked Tiffy. She shook her head, newbie. She said, bit of a strange character, came in with his wife to make the appointment. I think she wears the trousers. At 3 o'clock, Herr Hübner was standing outside the door, a man in his late 50s, gone to seed, in a slouchy grey hoodie and baggy grey jogging bottoms. He was looking through the window with unmistakable reluctance. His wife was standing next to him, a plump woman dressed in black, with unkempt long hair dyed bright red. On Herr Hübner's other side stood a young girl, thin, pale, flat-faced, an unassuming character only given shape by her eyes edged with black eyeliner. Presumably Herr Hübner's daughter. When I opened the door and introduced myself, he didn't want to give me his hand and hid behind his wife. She and her daughter tried to coax him inside. When that didn't help, they gave him a shove over the threshold with their combined strength, while he acted the lame horse. Herr Hübner looked around the reception area in fear and then at me with his strange watery eyes. I invited the family to take a seat while I prepared the foot bath. When I returned, I explained that the treatment would last an hour. The ladies were welcome to stay or they could go off and do some shopping. We'll stay, said the mother. The daughter nodded. I asked Herr Hübner to follow me into the chiropody room. I was followed not only by him, but also by the women, in single file. I said I'd rather his entourage waited in the reception area, but neither I nor the room's confined space, nor even the lack of chairs could drive the women away. They stood there, in the way, making it clear I should keep out of things I knew nothing about. I showed Herr Hübner to his place in the chiropody chair, and he turned around completely before sitting down hesitantly, as if he was afraid of getting dirty. I moved the footbath into position, and Herr Hubner took off his shoes, or rather kicked them off his feet. They were ancient Crocs with air holes, a faded black, and worn out of shape. What came into view was something from the animal kingdom. I've blanked out the stench of it. I realised Herr Hubner's appendages would have ruined any socks in seconds, and no closed shoe would have been able to house them. And so, for years on end, in summer and in winter, he'd gone around it with his bare feet in these rubber dinghy-shaped slippers. As Herr Hubner worked himself up to putting his feet in the water, he whimpered softly and turned his fearful puppy eyes to the women, who cajoled him again, reassuring and encouraging him to get through the difficult hour that lay ahead of him.